You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking some time out of a lovely afternoon to spend some time inside talking about what I hope is going to be a very exciting topic. So usually discussions of cybersecurity begin with, you know, someone pointing out that information technology has changed the world. I think we can all take these comments as read. You're all here because you agree with this. And let's focus on a fairly specific question, which is the future of digital surveillance. Now, this is a very timely question. On Thursday, we're going to be having hearings in the House Judiciary Committee. Congressman Sensenbrenner has titled the hearings "Going Dark: Lawful Electronic Surveillance in the Face of New Technologies." And elsewhere on the Hill, Congressman Mike Rogers has been talking about the need to revisit CALEA, saying the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, which we're going to hear a lot about today, saying that as long as it's consistent with due process, we're going to have to continue to expand surveillance. We know bad guys are communicating through Facebook and online video games, and it's foolish for America not to keep pace with the changing ways world of online communication. Now, on the flip side, we've all seen what happens when the wrong people pay attention to online communication. And Congressman Bill Keating has talked about how the Iranian and Egyptian protests have taught us that social media can be as powerful as any gun. And he's even cautioned us, saying that companies that are selling technology to countries using it to perpetuate human rights abuses must work with Congress to make this right. So this is a very current question to say, how are we going to think about what the government can and can't do for communication technology in terms of protecting us from legitimate harms, but at the same time respecting civil liberties and also other questions that we're going to be talking about today. Now, fortunately, in the face of a very current topic, we have Susan Landau, who has just written a book titled Surveillance or Security, The Risks Posed by the New Wiretapping Technologies, which has just come out by MIT Press. Susan is spending the year at the Radcliffe Institute, at Harvard Radcliffe, and but until 2010 was a staff engineer and then a distinguished engineer at Sun Microsystems, where she worked not only on technology issues but also a lot of policy issues, focusing on security from surveillance, digital rights management, and before that, cryptographic export control, and has some fun stories about that battle. Now, to balance the discussion, we have Stuart Baker, who comes to us from Steptoe and Johnson, but he was also the first assistant secretary of state, secretary at Department of Homeland Security for policy, and before that in the 1990s was general counsel of the National Security Agency, and has some incredible insights on what is actually going on, as well as some very unique and iconoclastic perspectives that will, I think, have a great discussion. So now I'd like to invite Susan to talk about where she thinks these new technologies are going and some of the risks that are going to be introduced. And then we'll have a panel discussion about sort of how do we measure these, how do we balance them, then we'll take questions from the audience.
Thank you very much, Alan. So Alan wants us to talk about the future, but you can't talk about the future until you think a little bit about the past. And I want to take you briefly back to 1992, when the U.S. government permitted the export of very strong cryptography, 40 bits. For those of you technically inclined, you know you can break it on your laptop in under a minute now. And in fact, it didn't take very long to break in the mid-1990s. The other thing that the U.S. government did in 1992 is that the FBI began pushing the passage of a bill called digital telephony. The FBI was worried about going dark. It was worried that it couldn't handle the new telephone technologies like call forwarding and other innovative technologies at the time, and it asked that all digitally switched telephone communications be built wiretap-enabled with the standards developed by the federal government. What happened in 1992 was not much. Industry was not happy by the U.S. government's concession, and Congress was not interested in the FBI's proposal. Nobody sponsored the bill. Move forward 2 years. Now, at that time, the FBI claimed that by 1994, 1996, 40 or 60% of all phone communications would be encrypted, except for those of you using Skype and government devices. I bet nobody ever talks on an encrypted phone yet. Move forward to 1994. When the FBI proposed its bill again, it changed the name to the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, and it threw in a sweetener to the telephone companies, $500 million to help update their systems. And the telephone companies dropped their opposition, so the only people left opposing was industry, the computer industry, and the civil liberties groups. And the FBI said, we don't need to have this bill apply to the Internet. We only want it for phone communications. What happened through the rest of the 1990s? Well, the U.S. government didn't want to see the export of devices with strong cryptography, and they didn't want to see the use domestically of devices with strong cryptography. So the way to do this was prevent export, and then computer companies wouldn't build things domestically that they couldn't ship abroad because half their market was abroad. But other things happened, too. You guys know when you type in www.amazon.com, you go to Amazon. But your computer doesn't actually know where Amazon is on the network. It does a lookup to find what's called the IP address, the Internet Protocol address of Amazon. Now, if you use Amazon enough, it might keep that stored relatively locally. But if you go somewhere new to the Brookings Institution page, to the House Judiciary Committee page, it has to look it up. What ensures that when you try to go to Bank of America, you're going to Bank of America and not something that looks like Bank of America? When you go down the street, there's no real problem because there's this red brick building with the ATM slot in it, and it would be really weird to have somebody build a red brick building with an ATM slot that says Bank of America that isn't, because you have to go through the whole permitting process. It takes a long time. It's an expensive process. And so you know when it says Bank of America and it has the ATM slot right in the building and there isn't something on top of the ATM slot that's spoofed, you know when you do that that you've got the real Bank of America building. But when you go to the virtual world and you try to have that in the virtual world, how do you know? Well, it turns out it's a real problem. And the U.S. and the computer scientists, the technologists, have a solution that involves digitally signing a whole bunch of URLs to ensure that when you type in Bank of America, you really get to Bank of America and not some spoof. We've had that system since the mid-1990s. But in the mid-1990s, the U.S. government prevented the export of this protocol abroad because it used cryptography. This was a very short-sighted plan. Now the U.S. government is pushing that. So, in fact, it's been federal policy for the last 2 years. Office of Management and Budget has required since 2009 that all federal civilian agencies use what's called DNSSEC. And, in fact, the military is requiring that for all military agencies. But in the 1990s, the U.S. government went the other way. So now I want to jump to now. And I want to jump to now in two different ways. The first way is attribution. And all of you know the problem of you get something from the network and you don't know if it's really from the person you thought it was. You don't know if the thing is coming from where you expect it to be. You don't know if you're getting the right information. And if you're in the military, you care a lot about attribution because, of course, you can't respond if you can't attribute it to the right place. So in the network, we have what are called layers. The application layer is what all of you know and love, and most of you think of as the Internet, Amazon, Facebook, Google. If you go down further in terms of how the network is actually architected, all of your messages, whether you're talking about an email, whether you're talking about an instant message, whether you're talking about a web page, is broken up into little packets, and your message transits the network in funny little ways all across. And in Washington, there's been a lot of talk the last couple of years. We need attribution of those packets. We need to know that those packets really are where they say they're from. But it turns out that the problem is actually a lot more subtle. There are a whole bunch of different crimes on the network. There's spam, which is problematic and annoying, and not a lot more. There's distributed denial of service attacks, what brought down Estonia a few years ago. The attacks on the Republic of Georgia during the time of the Russian war with Georgia. There are criminal activities on the network, and there's cyber exploitations, where somebody, parties unknown, go into a machine at Northrop Grumman or Lockheed Martin or the Defense Intelligence Agency and pull out material, and they do it very carefully and very well. They sit inside the machine for a long time looking at where the files of interest are, and when they decide to download them, It happens all very quickly, goes to a machine in Taiwan or a machine in Korea, and eventually seems to end up in southern China. Where it goes from there, we know not. And so the cry in Washington is, we need to be able to attribute those attacks. We need the packets, the low-level pieces of information that transit the Internet, to tell us where they're coming from. So I looked at this problem with a colleague at MIT, and we began to think about what is the real problem. When you look at a DDoS attack, when you look at a distributed denial-of-service attack, what you're interested in doing is stopping the attack. That's the only thing you want to do. Sure, you'd like to get back at the guy who did it to you, but that's much less important than stopping it. And I don't know how many of you have watched what happened when Amazon pulled WikiLeaks. When Amazon pulled WikiLeaks, it was the subject of a denial-of-service attack. But for Amazon, denial-of-service is kind of like Christmas. It's when everybody comes to their machine to try and order books for the holidays. Amazon withstood the attack without a problem. The fact is, you can architect to withstand the problem, and you can protect yourself against the problem. For criminal activities, it's really useful to know where the packets come from, because that's the start of an investigation. And every law enforcement person will tell you that. But notice the word I used. Start. At the end of the investigation, you need to tie a real human being to the criminal activity. That means you need to see who withdraws the money from the ATM machine, who takes that stolen credit card and buys things with it, and so on. And so attaching identity to this low-level information is not that useful. As for cyber exploitation, well, let me stop a minute and tell you the two different techniques used in criminal activities. The first one is a multi-step attack, in which, for example, somebody downloads information about you from TJ Maxx, and then later takes that information to create a credit card in your name. That's multi-step, the step of downloading the information and then creating the fake credit card. Multi-stage is something else. It's when that data is taken from the machine at Fort Waukacha and downloaded to a machine in Taiwan, and then downloaded to a machine in Korea, and then downloaded to a machine in China. When it's downloaded to Taiwan, as long as we have a judicial relationship, a legal relationship with Taiwan, we can ask for the ability to examine the machine where the data went, to examine the ISP. And then we can find, oh, it went to Korea. But as soon as it disappears into the dark Neverland, where we don't have judicial legal connections, we can't do anything. We can't find out, did it stay in China? Did it go to Russia? Did it go somewhere else? And so that begins to make it clear that the whole issue of cyber exploitation, which is, by the way, the most serious cybersecurity problem we have. It's not cyber war. It's cyber exploitation. William Lynn, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, wrote in Foreign Affairs last summer that the most serious long-term national security threat, cybersecurity threat, is cyber exploitation. That the amount of data being stolen, intellectual property, business plans, patents, research ideas, and so on, is so huge it swamps the Library of Congress each year. So the problem there is not solved by technical means, it's solved by legal means. And it's a complicated one. Now, as Alan mentioned, law enforcement is having some trouble wiretapping these days. There are all sorts of new communications technologies. Google came up with one a couple of weeks ago in Egypt, in which its newly acquired Say Now was combined with Twitter and Google Speak to Voice, and it enabled the Egyptians to be able to get messages out even when the Internet was down. There are all types of new communications technologies, and they provide a real challenge to law enforcement, and that's true. And so what law enforcement would like to do is change CALEA. Now, I say what law enforcement would like to do. I don't know what law enforcement would like to do. There are a series of New York Times and Washington Post articles that say law enforcement would like to do this, law enforcement would like to do that. They haven't been followed up with an administration bill yet. But the New York Times and Washington Post articles say expand CALEA to Internet communications. The problem with doing so is that Internet communications are fragile. We wouldn't be having conversations about cybersecurity if we knew how to protect the Internet. we wouldn't be having any of these conversations. If we had security on the network, this wouldn't be a problem. The issue of Kalia on the internet, Kalia involves building wiretapping capability into the fabric of the communication system. And when you do that, you've got what we call in the trade an architected security breach. Let me tell you some examples of when these have happened. In Greece in 2004-2005, 100 senior members of the Greek government, including the prime minister, the head of the Ministry of Defense, of the Interior, and so on, were wiretapped for 10 months. The intruders broke into a switch in Vodafone Greece network. The switch had wiretaping capabilities in it, not because Vodafone Greece wanted them. They hadn't paid for them, so they weren't supposed to be switched on. But Ericsson, who built the switch, had put it in to comply with European standards on wiretapping. Because it wasn't purchased, the auditing capability wasn't part of the switch. Somebody went into the switch, turned on the wiretapping capability, and tapped 100 members of the Greek government for 10 months. I can tell you in great detail how it was done. I can't tell you who did it. It stopped when Vodafone Greece discovered some SMS messages went awry, tried to figure out what happened. The wiretapping stopped, but we still don't know who did it. Telecom Italia, for a period of 10 years, 6,000 Italians, 1 out of 10,000 Italians, 6,000 Italians were wiretapped. This included judges, business people, celebrities, sports figures. Think about it. Why would you wiretap those people? Blackmail and bribes. Insider attack. When you build wiretapping capability that can be easily turned on, people from the outside can do it, as in the Greek case, and people from the inside can do it, as in apparently from the Telecom Italia case. The case happened 1996 to 2006. It is still wending its way through the Italian courts. Another example is that a IBM researcher, Tom Cross, discovered a year ago that a Cisco architecture for IP networks, for wiretapping IP networks, compliant with European standards, can be spoofed. What that means is some bad guy sitting inside law enforcement, like a Robert Hansen, can go and look at whether or not he's being wiretapped and can shut off the auditing capability so that nobody ever knows he looked at the system. In fact, if we look at the FBI system for wiretapping IP networks, Carnivore, later renamed DCS-3000, it was also possible to spoof it because it had very poor auditing capability. So we need to think about what our serious risks are. At the time we passed Kalia, we said the serious risks were organized crime, drug dealing, kidnapping, although kidnapping was something of a red herring because it turns out that wiretaps are very rarely used in kidnapping cases. You don't know who the kidnapper is. You can't tap their phone. And if you want to listen into the family, that's not a wiretap, either legally or technically. So wiretaps are used only 4 or 5 times, maybe 6 times a year in the 450 wiretaps we have in the 450 kidnapping cases we have. That was then. Now our risk is cyber exploitation. Now our national security risk is cyber exploitation. And the risks come from nation states on the outside and sometimes from insiders on the inside the company. Fairchild Semiconductor lost thousands of pages of information to the Japanese consulate in San Francisco 20, 30 years ago. Lost enough information that it suffered a takeover attack from Fujitsu and the U.S. government had to bail it out. The other issue is that switches last a very long time. When you build a wiretapping capability into a switch now, or you do it in 1994 or 1996 to comply with Kalia, switches last a lot longer than your PDAs, your laptops, your cell phones. Those last 2 years, 3 years at the outside. Switches used to last 40. They don't last quite as long. But the point is that threat models change, and we're stuck with a surveillance technology that's looking at us. So I've told you what law enforcement wants. Let me tell you a little bit about what the NSA wants. And now I think that Stu and I will have some interesting tangling. In the 1990s, the NSA fought very hard against allowing crypto to be exported, products with strong cryptography. That also prevented the use of products with strong cryptography domestically, which made the FBI happy. 1999, the NSA changed its mind. Changed its mind for a number of reasons, including if U.S. industry didn't produce those products, somebody else was gonna, and one of the things about the U.S. industry producing it is NSA could sometimes get a look-see at the U.S. products ahead of time and figure out how to go around the crypto, but they couldn't do that when stuff was made abroad. But the other issue is that one of the important aspects of the NSA, the part that never gets the publicity, is the Information Assurance Directorate. It's only 15% of the budget, but it's 50% of the mission. Its job is to keep U.S. government material safe, U.S. government information safe. But the NSA periodically dabbles in information elsewhere. When IBM was being wiretapped by the Russians in Glen Cove in the 1970s, they were communicating via a private network using microwave towers. NSA went to IBM and said, you need to change this. You're in trouble, guys. And so the NSA has had a very interesting response over the last 10 years. It has approved a public algorithm for use in top secret communications. It has come up with a suite of algorithms that were set that are NIST standards that came through the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, a civilian agency. It has approved those standards for use in building a secure communications network. It has allowed soldiers in Iraq to buy commercial off-the-shelf equipment for developing secure communications. Because when they were working in Iraq with Iraqi forces, they needed to be able to have systems put together quickly. So the NSA interest has changed somewhat. The NSA is saying, we got to have this out in the public sector. In fact, I was talking to somebody at the Information Assurance Directorate a year ago, and he was talking to me about first responders. First responders, police, fire, ambulance, use land mobile radio. They can't use cell or internet because that might go down in a crisis. They can't use satellite because sometimes clouds or mountains or tall buildings block them. So they use land mobile radio. If you think about it, police car has a gazillion different antennas. That's because they need an antenna to communicate within their district. They need an antenna to communicate outside their district. They need an antenna to communicate with EMTs inside their district, outside their district, fire inside, outside. That's all the antennas they've got. Pretty stupid. And what this man said, the technical director from the Information Assurance Division of NSA said, he said, I want to see secure land mobile radio available in Radio Shack, because then it's cheap and easy for all first responders to have. But of course, it's not only first responders who are going to buy secure land mobile radio. It's a lot of the bad guys too. Now you could say, well, NSA doesn't have to worry about the bad guys on the inside, but people in the government do. Yet it is NSA policy. Let's push secure communications out there. So, as I look at the world we've got, what is it we need? Well, I've told you a little bit about security. The events of the last 3 weeks also told you a little bit about security against the government. And so another thing that's gone on in the last 20 years is that U.S. diplomats are less in presence in certain places the last 10 years. And they often rely on NGOs, on oil companies. Oil companies know more about what's happening in parts of Indonesia than the U.S. government. Those people need secure communications. So does law enforcement and national security need secure communications of a different sort. They sometimes need anonymized communications. Sometimes there are Navy personnel working in the Middle East and they will need to communicate back with Annapolis. But nobody in the Middle East knows that they're Navy personnel. They're just guys. And so they need a form of communication that hides who they're communicating with. And that type of communication, the onion routing, was developed at the Naval Research Labs to anonymize who the endpoints of a communication are. But it's not used just by the military and law enforcement. It's used more broadly, because if it's just U.S. military and law enforcement who use it, then it's pretty easy to tell those guys in the Mideast are U.S. personnel. So the saying in the trade is, anonymity loves company. And that product has been released for public use. You can go to the Onion Routing Tor at tor.eff.org to find it. So we have very interesting efforts on the side of the U.S. government pushing for anonymity and pushing for secure communications. What we need to do as we think about all these issues is first and foremost focus on the serious threats. So the drug dealer on the corner is a threat, but he's not the same threat as the cyber exploitation. We need to put our focus on what are the serious threats. We also need to know that secure communications are fundamental. They're fundamental for political discourse, they're fundamental for business discourse, and as we know, they're fundamental, as we know on Valentine's Day, they're fundamental for private discourse. The preamble to the Constitution says that the U.S. government should secure blessings of freedom for posterity. When you build wiretapping capability into a switch, you're doing the exact opposite. Communication surveillance should be designed with the idea of securing blessings of freedom for posterity in mind. One of the things that happened under the last administration is that one single person sitting in the Department of Justice wrote a memo that said it's okay to wiretap warrantlessly for foreign intelligence surveillance. That got pushed up through the Attorney General, and for a period of 5 years, we had the warrantless wiretapping with no public knowledge of it. 4 years. We should never have a system in place that one person can turn a switch and start wiretapping us. We need to have public vetting of security solutions, and we should also have a public agency supporting communications security. The NSA is a very interesting creature. It's got communications intelligence and communications security, and in some sense they keep each other honest. But we don't have anything like that in the public sector, and it's something we need. The FBI did a little bit of that about educating businesses, but not enough. And, of course, it couldn't really, because it has a mixed mission. We need to have that outside the Department of Homeland Security, and we need to have it because it's important for both our freedom and our security. So with that, I look forward to Stu's response.
Let me try to respond to that quickly. I think, you know, it was a very appealing suggestion that we need to make technical changes to our architecture or resist technical changes, depending on what you're proposing, because we all need security, and this is certainly the case. We do all need security online. The difficulty I have is that it's an argument for building that security in a fashion that it can't really be touched by even democratic governments because it's built into the architecture of the technology we use. So that these changes are, these policies are established really by the people who architect our technology. It's a kind of geekocracy in which the geeks determine whether we're going to have more security or more law enforcement. And in some respects, that's what we've had for the last 20 years. I remember quite vividly the early days of the fight over crypto, in which these guys came in from the West Coast, couldn't believe we were going to get in their way at all. I mean, we want crypto in your toaster so that you can communicate with your toaster in case you need to adjust how brown it gets while you're driving home. That idea that we had to have the security, and that if we would just drop export controls on encryption, the geeks would deliver us security, and because we needed security, we should do what the geeks said, was actually, in the end, after a long and bruising fight that left everybody a little chastened, it was the outcome that industry got. And I'm sure you all realize how much more secure you are online than you were in 1995, right? You know, the security that we were promised was never delivered. However, Al-Qaeda today has, and many other terrorist groups, have perfect communication security when they wish to communicate operationally. That capability has been widely spread, and it has been widely spread. You know, we don't use crypto when we make phone calls because we don't really think anybody's listening. We may be wrong, but we don't expect people to be listening. Terrorist groups do. So they have adopted this technology. We've gotten, in some senses, the worst of both worlds. We have widespread encryption available to everybody, but we don't use it because it's a hassle, and the terrorists do, and as a result have perfect communications security. This is not, you know, this was not the world that was envisioned when we were being sold the idea that if we just got rid of export controls on encryption, we would have a secure infrastructure. And that tells us that these solutions are often much more difficult, much more complex than the people who are architecting them ever envision. And I think if I heard right what Susan was saying, she was saying, look, we still need security. So again, you should give me all of my policy choices and then instantiate them in the technology so they can't be changed. We shouldn't have built-in wiretap capabilities because that reduces security. We should instead take the anonymity technologies and the other security technologies that have been adopted by some portions of the U.S. government and push them out there as rapidly as possible so that we'll have security and all those people in Tahrir Square will have security. And isn't that a good thing? You want them to have security. You want to have security, don't you? And we all nod. And quite correctly, we do. But the fact is that we will be providing security to the people who care most about it, who have the most to fear from authority around the world, and that often will turn out to be people who do not have the interests of anybody in this room at heart. And if we make those decisions as a matter of architecture, we will regret it, as indeed I think we are regretting some of the architectural decisions that were made by privacy-loving, libertarian technologists in the 80s and the 1990s. Let me talk briefly about attribution. I don't want to take too much time so that we can begin the dialogue. Susan, I think I give her credit for acknowledging that attribution really is important. Although at the end I thought she was saying, well, really, attribution isn't going to be the most important thing. What we need is security, and the implication was that somehow anonymity would give us security, or that we could get security with dropping Kalia as a mechanism for protection, and none of that, it seems to me, is correct. Attribution at the end of the day is a critical mechanism for determining for establishing social order, and I think that's probably the most important part of our approach to attribution. If you look at how societies have dealt with the problem of maintaining social order, you can actually see this is remarkably built into our genome. There are people who are so determined to enforce the norms of their society that they actually get pleasure, rewards in their reward centers for punishing people who have violated the rules that govern their society, even if the people who are doing the punishment actually suffer as a result of that. It's a kind of altruistic punishment, probably 60% of people do actually get pleasure from imposing pain on people that they believe have violated the standards of society. This is not news to anybody who drives in Washington. But what's significant about it is that it tells us that punishment is at the heart of the way in which we have developed our society and our social order. And we're not likely ever to be able to come up with a system in which we maintain social order without actually punishing people who violate the rules. And it seems to me that when we look at the question of attribution, it's about punishing people who have violated the rules. It's about when you're looking at it at a nation-state level, attribution is necessary in order to retaliate, sometimes massively, sometimes proportionately, to an attack that comes from a nation-state. You have to know which nation-state launched the attack. The same thing is true with cyber espionage. If you want to punish countries that have engaged in cyber espionage, then you have to attribute the attack. You have to determine who is attacking you. If it's criminal hacking, you have to determine who has engaged in the criminal activity and then subject them to prosecution, arrest and prosecution. All of those things depend on being able to attribute the attack and identify the attacker. The kinds of attacks that you can stop just by building your defenses higher might consist of denial of service attacks. If I had to identify the kind of cyber attack I was least worried about, it would be denial of service. That is still largely solvable if you have big enough pipes or your ISP is sophisticated enough and you pay the ISP enough money. Whether that will always be true, hard to say, but today that is true. And so denial of service attacks are our least troublesome form of attack. It's also the case, as the guys in 4chan and Anonymous are going to discover, it ain't particularly anonymous way of attacking people, and there will be retribution. Those guys are going to get arrested, and indeed they are getting arrested and prosecuted for launching the post-Wikipedia attacks. So the question then becomes, how do you get attribution in the current in our current system? And the answer is not without making architectural changes. And I certainly agree that there are multi-stage attacks in which people move from one compromised machine to a second, to a third, to a fourth, to a fifth, all in different countries. But the answer really that Susan has offered to us is, well, you should follow legal process. And I think it's fair to say that legal process as a mechanism for addressing that problem has completely failed. We have had since the 1980s an international policy of bringing people into a convention in which every country agrees that certain things are crimes and they will quickly respond to requests for information as we try to track the attacker back from machine to machine so that we can collect IP addresses. I think it's fair to say that we are at roughly 15% of the world's nations have signed on to that. And the process still operates on a days or weeks basis while the attackers are operating on microseconds. And that's not likely to succeed if we continue to rely simply on solving the problem through our existing legal process. We're going to have to come up with mechanisms that allow attackers to be identified across those multiple steps rather than simply relying on old-fashioned legal systems that will never be able to catch up with the attackers. Why don't I stop there, and I'll let Susan respond to that.
So I think we need a moment while someone comes and allows everyone to hear us.
Of course.
So I don't know how you knew, Stuart, but I would want to respond. So I think it's a little bit disingenuous. Maybe I should let your expression be seen before I say it. I think it's a little bit disingenuous for you to say that, gee, we haven't got any improved security over what we had in 1995 when the policies of 1975 to 2000 prevented the use of crypto in many things, including, as I said, in cases of authentication and integrity.
Well, the four people who were using the Internet in 1975 might have been aggrieved by that, but you properly set the bar at about 1992,
yes.
1994, when this became a debate, and admitted that by 1999 the policy had changed. It actually had changed for authentication before that.
But
so
we
had 10 years in the promised land. Where the hell is our security?
You know as well as I know how long it takes to get products out there. And we had, and in fact, even though it had changed for authentication and so on.
Have you looked at the apps market?
Yes. But let me go on with some other points. You said the terrorists have perfect communication security. Osama bin Laden does not use electronic communications because we pick him up. Colleague Sheikh Mohammed got picked up through transactional information. That is how he was found in Pakistan. There was a very interesting case in Switzerland where the communication between two terrorists consisted of a phone call, the phone being picked up and then hung up. But they got arrested anyway. How come? Because these guys bought anonymous phone cards and they bought them in a stack. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And so the law enforcement was tracking. Okay, card number one got used. Okay, card number two got used. And they tracked where the cards were being used. It is not to say that the bad guys aren't using these forms of secure communication. If the only thing that wiretap did was kept the bad guys off the networks, off the communications networks, that would be a wonderful usage. That's what happened with organized crime. Organized crime people did not use the telephones by the 1990s. You had to put bugs in their houses because you couldn't tap them. I mean, you could tap them, but you didn't get anything. That's a valid use, but it's not correct to say that the bad guys are all over the phone wires because they're not.
They have perfect encryption. I agree with you that the transactional information surrounding those communications is still a fatal flaw, that if you're a well-known terrorist and you use modern communications, you're going to get a 500-pound bomb sooner or later down your chimney.
Right, right. There was that interesting case in Yemen where the NSA analyst recognized the voice on the call, and there was a drone that exploded the car very
shortly
thereafter.
Actually, I think it was in the front seat. The guy was talking in the back seat, and there was somebody talking in the front seat. He said, I know who that is. Yeah.
So we're going to try over the course of this discussion to
yes, sort
of get our – no. There are some times when the moderator knows just to get the hell out of the way. But what I think it's important to do is get our terms straight. So what we've done now, as we said, there's a difference between encryption and security. And we've learned that part of that is – things like authentication, and part of that is things like auditing. So we understand we have very good encryption right now, thanks in part to some of the work of you and your colleagues, and security, still a very big problem. But to have a narrow view at the moment of the question of wiretapping, what I'd love to do is get a vision of what you think, roughly sketched out, you'd like to see. What powers would you like to see? How far would you like to see CLIA extended? And alternatively, if we're not going to build backdoors into all these platforms and bad people are using these platforms to communicate, how should we, what should the law enforcement look like? What should the intelligence community have the power to do? And is it currently sufficient? So, want to start?
So I'll confess a moment of ambiguity and ambivalence, which I'm not known for.
You're going to floor us all, Stu.
Yeah, sorry. Because, in fact, I think this is a hard one, and it may explain why the FBI and maybe the Justice Department can't get a bill out of the administration. It's very hard to see how you end up in a substantially better place at a cost that you're prepared to pay if you go down this regulatory road. Yes, there are certain kinds of very mainstream telecommunication services that are not subject to CLIA, and it's very tempting to say we need to go after them. And maybe that makes sense. The problem is people who want to have telecommunications in the current system will be able to find ways to do that using a variety of apps and software and the like that'll be almost impossible to control because they'll come from everywhere in the world, and you won't be able to stop them because they're simply selling or giving away software, and you can't prevent people from giving it away. You can't prevent people from installing it on their Android, and then they've got an open 3G network. They just use that for their telecommunications, and you're screwed.
All right, and do you think there are directions that we should take?
I have a lot of sympathy for the view that when the FBI made the deal they made, which is, okay, we'll leave the Internet alone, that they made a choice that needs to be revisited. In fact, they have.
Yeah, I mean, yeah,
they really, have squeezed a lot out of CALEA that probably is not in CALEA. And it might make sense to say, gee, why don't we at least put what they already have in the law and pick up some of the additional obvious mainstream telecommunications services that are being offered. But I doubt that it's really going to solve the FBI's problem in a complete fashion.
All right. Susan, do you have thoughts?
Sure. So part of the answer is this has to do with money, but I want to start somewhere else, which is that I described a situation in which the NSA is living with the world as it is. And obviously they have ways of figuring out the communications they're hearing, or not hearing, but figuring these things out. The FBI and local law enforcement are case-based agencies. They get a case, they investigate it, they discover they can't wiretap, they're getting gobbledygook on the wiretap, they try to figure it out. That's a very pressured situation. There may be lives on the line. It's a very frustrating situation. It's the wrong approach. Back in 1996, the National Research Council produced a report, Cryptography's Role on Securing the Information Society, Crisis Report. And they said then, the FBI needs a research arm to deal with advanced telecommunications. Instead of waiting till there's a case, the FBI guys should be doing what any researchers do. There should be an office within the FBI that goes to communications conferences, that goes to computer science conferences, that meets with the people doing startups, and figures out what the new interesting communications technologies are and develops tools for wiretapping them so that the tool is available at the time the case comes up. It's not going to be foolproof. Nothing is ever going to be foolproof unless you make everybody use the old black telephone that I grew up with, and we're not in that world, and we're not going to be in that world anymore. But that's the solution I would give. Now, you're going to say that costs money, and we're in a time when we don't have money to spend. But any CALEA-type solution, any solution that builds wiretapping capabilities into switches, whether digitally switched telephone networks or the Internet, costs money. And it's a question of whether the consumers pay, whether they get shifted on to the telcos and the service providers, or whether you say this is an important way for the FBI to maintain its capability without impinging on cybersecurity.
Well, I mean, I understand the appeal to geeks of having the FBI come out to them on bended knee or maybe holding cash and saying, could you design your product so that it's more friendly to law enforcement?
I didn't say that, Stu.
But that's what you envision the FBI doing, is figuring out what's happening and then hoping that if they go ask the geeks, that the geeks will respond. But, you know, in my experience, about a quarter of Silicon Valley engineers would like nothing better than an opportunity to tell the FBI where to put it. And so the likelihood that they're going to respond, especially if they can make a business case for security, which you always can, strikes me as pretty modest. And the idea of having people kind of build in this way, that way, any which way, something they think will help the FBI strikes me as inconsistent with your concern that those sorts of solutions will reduce security.
I'm talking about the FBI doing this in-house in the same way that the NSA does it in-house. I'm not talking about the FBI bringing cash to companies. I'm talking about the FBI sniffing around and finding what new communications technologies are coming down the pike.
And spending whatever it takes to fix
but
it.
But so we have set up in the last 5 years a number of institutions that span across governments and that are supposed to bring in expertise from the NSA. Do you think there is the possibility of cooperation on that level to bring some of the technology from the intelligence side
down to the law enforcement side? I do believe that law enforcement, it's kind of embarrassing that law enforcement doesn't have the sort of centralized research capability and R&D approach that, say, DOD has. And I always thought that that would make a lot of sense, if not of the Justice Department, probably DHS should be doing that. They may have more law enforcement people and more responsibility for local law enforcement than DOJ. But it's almost impossible to persuade the people who run law enforcement agencies to invest in technology. They're, as they see it, they're surrounded by opportunities to arrest bad guys. And if they've got enough money to hire four more guys, they could put more bad guys away. And they are unable to resist that temptation and disinclined to invest that money in something that will pay off, if at all, 10 years from now, and maybe, God forbid, for a rival agency.
Which, interestingly enough, this idea of how do you put your resources, you said it's always easy to make a business case for security. I would argue in the private sector it's quite the opposite. If you can invest in information security against an unknown risk, you can also invest in new ways to improve your business processes.
Well, you're right. It is actually hard to sell security most of the time if it costs a lot. My favorite story is the Air Force general who, when NSA went to him and said, we've got this new crypto module, we want to install it in your planes. He said, well, I only want three things from your crypto. It's got to be free, it's got to be invisible, and it's got to add a little lift to the plane. That is the general security approach. But certainly the idea of building in a security hole, a non-starter.
Well, and we talked about building in a securities hole into switches.
Right.
So now let's look forward to, we have someone basically saying, people are using online games to communicate. People are using all sorts of things at the application layer, which brings into play a couple of different questions. One, information collection is often divided up into communications information, transactional information, and then data at rest. Now, it seems to me as we sort of munge all these into the application layer, it's much harder to disentangle them. Can you give us any way of how we should think about them, or should we get rid of those laws and bring in some new ways of thinking about how to gather information?
I don't think it's particularly hard when it's in the application layer to separate what the communication is, what the transactional information. So transactional information, and I don't think we properly defined it, is the who, what, when of a communication. And it is often remarkably revelatory. So I don't believe I said that a very interesting fact is that since the cell phone era, the U.S. Marshals Service now takes 2 days to capture a bad guy instead of 42, because all they have to do is see where his cell phone is at night, where his cell phone is in the morning, and look where family and friends are in that cell phone sector. And then they go to the apartment the second morning, and they got the guy, and they're on to the next case. So transactional information picked up one of the London bombers of 721. Transactional information is really valuable. But transactional information, content, and stored data, I think even at the application layer, is not hard to keep separate. I'm not sure why you consider them munched together. So we'll have to talk offline.
Okay. And just to push this a little further,
please.
From the case of industrial espionage, if we want to enable ready access to transactional data for law enforcement, could this not also be useful from all of the malefactors we're talking about, whether they're terrorists or foreign military or economic espionage?
There is, as far as I can see, fairly ready access already to transactional information. Prospectively, it's a subpoena. Mm-hmm. Retrospectively, it's a national security letter. It's really readily, and often the two are given at once. It's readily available. I don't think that's a problem for law enforcement.
Okay.
As long as there's somebody you can safely serve the subpoena on, they're not involved in the a particular activity that you're worried about. I agree. Right now, transactional data is saving law enforcement from a world in which it's harder to get content, but there's a vast amount of digital data about us suddenly available with relative ease.
So
I want to move to some of the fun theoretical topics we talked about, because whenever you have a discussion like this, you start talking about anonymity and attribution. And Stuart, your point about this idea of social regulation is near and dear to my heart. I love mathematical models of complex behavior. But I wonder if you can sort of talk about how those can evolve and how important we need what types of identity information. Can we have attribution at the IP level, as Susan mentioned? Do we need to have attribution going all the way up to the legal entity? And how should we think about that in the face of threats like espionage, terrorism?
So I wish I had sufficient technical expertise to hold forth in detail on that. It seems to me pretty clear that we're going one, obviously you can't usually attribute beyond the machine, although increasingly I think the machine will require that you identify yourself to the machine to use it, and you'll probably use your cell phone, and that will bring with it that sort of, I always envision us as Pigpen in the Charlie Brown cartoons. There's just this haze of data surrounding us, constantly sort of falling out and being generated. And I think we'll start discovering that you could, in fact, identify the people behind the machine getting access to some of that haze of data, that some of which will be used to authenticate people to the machine itself. But I fear if you're going to have mechanisms to identify people through the multi-stage attacks, you've got to have a mechanism that allows you to say, this either I can go right back to the ISP and get instant information about the hops that are occurring, or I need to start finding information added to the packets as the hops occur that allows me to pursue that back to the original location. This is a significant technical undertaking, and I don't know. I'm suspicious because 25% of Silicon Valley will tell me that's impossible without having examined the technical possibilities. So I'm not sure whether it's technically capable, something we can do technically, but I don't see a solution beyond that. If you cannot punish people who violate the norms online, sooner or later you will find that everybody has discovered there's a business model in violating those norms, and it will not be safe, as increasingly it is not safe, to do business online, to interact online, and as we put more and more of our lives online, more and more of our lives will be subject to more and more attacks. Eventually we're going to say we can't live this way, and I think we should start designing a system that allows us to identify and punish wrongdoers, because, as Susan says, it does take a while to roll out. I was struck by the fact that in 1996, I was told that U.S. encryption policy had failed because IPv6 had just been adopted. And it was going to, when it became universal, U.S. policy would be irrelevant. We are, of course, famously still waiting for IPv6 to be adopted.
Well, IPv4 has run out of addresses, so it's now actually going to happen.
So,
let me start with the attribution, because that's where we're having a conflict. And I guess I'm one of the 25, I'm one of the 75% who's actually thought about the problem rather than saying instantly no. And the.
But you still came out the same place.
Yeah. But I worked on it for a while. And the reason for the no is that as long as it's in a jurisdiction where you can continue to trust and examine, you can look at the machine, you can look at the ISP, no problem. It's when it gets out of that jurisdiction and you no longer, you don't know what's happening there.
Right.
And that's the problem.
So we do have a global internet, so we do have the problem, right?
We do have
the problem. You're arguing for a non-global internet?
No, I am not arguing for a non-global internet, Stuart. What I'm arguing is that when the packets are traced to China or to Russia or to a bunch of other countries, at that point, you lose the ability to trace them back further because you can't get at the machine and you can't get at the ISP.
Right, which is why you need architectural systems that actually do track it back, that are not subject to political...
So do you think your former agency would like the ability, would like the entire network to be so transparent that any investigation they did could be traced back?
My former agency would hate that world. But at the end of the day, if I have to choose between security and the kind of espionage my former agency does, I think I have to choose security. We have seen
so what the risk. So we're flipping roles for a minute, but let me push it a little bit further.
Quick, get those wiretaps out of the room.
Let me push it a little bit further and say that I don't think we could possibly see worldwide acceptance of such a protocol. I think technically it's very, what you're describing is technically very hard because the only way I could see to do it is to I apologize for being technical, to rehash and rehash and rehash. Yeah. And that's you don't want to do that at the speed at which packets are going. So that's problem number one.
Computers are getting faster. Come on.
Problem number one. Problem number two is I don't see legal acceptance in large swaths of the world.
I disagree. I actually think most of the world is much less enamored of the lone libertarian standing up to government than we are, and quite happy to adopt
I wasn't thinking of the part of the world that cares about the lone libertarian. I was thinking of the part of the world that cares not a whit about the lone libertarian, but doesn't want its activities chased.
Well, maybe. They have to make the same choice that I just had to make.
They control their pipes, and they're doing fine inside their countries.
So. And at some point, you do say, fine, we ain't taking,
you want to stand up at
we
some
ain't
point.
Taking your packets, because I think that's what it comes to at the end of the day.
But we could do that now and not have a problem.
So, and I think the challenge for attribution is if we have this model where we can say either you buy into this brand new non-internet, I think it's oftenly referred to as we'll have a green internet and a red internet. The red internet will be like what we have today. The green one will somehow be magically secure. So assume that we have one of those. Then if you don't buy into it, we can reduce the problem to a nation state problem, and that's a solved problem. And this is Richard Clark's approach to it, is saying let's just reduce it down to the boundary of the nation state, and then we can revert to the classic tools. So before we turn over to the audience for some questions, I want to tie this in to whether or not we should care about whether other governments should care about the lone libertarian or the lone freedom fighter or the crowd of freedom fighters, and get some sense from you on how important do you think it is to continue the U.S. efforts for internet freedom. A report is going to be coming out this week to assess the Department of State's efforts and try to suggest new directions. Is this something that we should really be pouring effort into, and if so, does it send a mixed message when other parts of our government are focused on other aspects of the information infrastructure?
Well, I think the problem with the State Department's most extreme views is this sort of techno-libertarian psychological takeover that they've suffered. And so if we just give these tools out, we'll you know, free the world. You really are, you know, you're channeling John Perry Barlow from 1995. His day is over, and thank goodness. But the idea of letting tools loose that will allow people who are engaged in worthwhile activity to communicate securely is a good idea, but the idea that we should just say, oh, well, let's find a security technology and release it, let's release the Tor, I think is probably the wrong solution. And indeed, a lot of the people who are trying to make sure information gets out securely have had to struggle with the question of how do I make sure this is not taken over by child pornographers? And they have struggled with, and in some cases successfully struggled with that problem. And I think that the State Department needs to look for mechanisms for dealing with this this issue that are a little more nuanced than otherwise.
So while I agree that we should look down on techno-determinists, libertarian or not, that's, I think, is an orthogonal question. I think that Tor, the onion router that Susan talked about, is actually one of the few examples where someone released the technology, a few people put it in people's hands, and it took off like wildfire. The challenge is it doesn't scale to enable 3 billion people to have a global democratic dialogue. It's very good for small actors.
Right. No, that one is an anonymizing tool about who's communicating with whom. I was on a federal advisory board a few years ago, and by law, by statute, there's one member of the NSA from that on that board. He and I were the only holdouts of no cell phone and no easy pass card because we didn't want to be tracked. But finally I had to break down because there are just no pay phones left anymore. The FBI got scolded, more than scolded, got a very negative report by the Inspector General, its Inspector General, a few years ago for its use of exigent letters, which were an even weakened form of national security letters. They were supposed to be followed up by national security letters to track people's transactional information. One of the striking examples to me at the time is that the FBI had reason to believe that a Washington Post reporter was speaking to terrorists, and so they wanted the reporter's list of communications. Not the contents, just the numbers with whom the reporter was communicating. But the order that got handed over to the communications assistant, that got handed over to the phone companies, did not include dates on it. And so a much larger swath was given. I can't think of anything more chilling to freedom of the press than that. And that's within the domestic United States. So we have moved from a world in which anonymous communication was very easy because payphones were in every corner, to the fact that even if you shut off your cell phone and use a payphone, if you can find one, the French government actually tracks when cell phones get shut off and fake credit cards get used. So if a fake credit card is being used, they want to know all the cell phones in the area, and they look at which ones got shut off as it moved into the area, and they go after that person.
Digitally find the dog that didn't bark.
That's right, exactly. So we have moved the whole world, as, you know, in the same way that law enforcement finds itself going dark because of new communications technologies, privacy and anonymity has gone dark the other way. And so I think the State Department, to no surprise, I think the State Department responses are quite reasonable.
All right. Want to open it up to the audience for questions, just if you could. We have some mics coming around, and you can identify yourself and where you're from, and remember, of course, a question is short and ends in a question mark. Ben.
Hi, Ben Wittes from Brookings.
Is it on?
Is it? I was, I'm fascinated by the idea of, you know, CALEA technologies as engineered security breaches. But it seems to me if you want to conclude that they have net security, they cause net security loss rather than net security gain, you have to compare the aggregate loss that to which they have contributed and to which you can attribute to them to the gains, the security gains associated with the investigative products of lawful wiretaps. And I'm wondering if you've looked into that at all and how you, I hate the word balance in these contexts, but how you compare you were sort of dismissive about the idea that you know, these are corner drug dealers that you catch this way. I suspect, you know, an FBI guy would say, well, wait a minute, we've done a lot with wiretaps. I'm just interested how you compare the fruits of wiretaps under CALEA with the engineered loss that you're describing.
Right. So very good question. And the answer, part of the answer is, I can't tell you which wiretaps occurred under CALEA and which ones not. I can't remember the number of Title III taps. I want to claim they're about 2,300, 2,400 a year under Title III, which are the criminal investigations. I would like to say that 85 to 90% of them are organized crime. You do not see terrorism cases come up under the Title III taps. That doesn't mean a CALEA tap doesn't aid in a terrorism case. It just means that you don't get the data on it.
Presumably the same technology, the CALEA-compliant technologies that's enabling the Title III tap is also enabling a FISA tap, right?
Correct. But we don't have any data on how many terrorism taps there were. We also don't have any data on how important CALEA was to the actual tapping mechanism. That is, could the tap have gone through without CALEA, and there's no information on that, I'm sure.
And this is, I think, the key aspect of, maybe you can reframe your question in terms of cost-effectiveness. Do you have thoughts on cost-effectiveness of different wiretapping regimes?
I think at this point it's hard to imagine that there are any wiretaps that are not enabled by CALEA. In the metropolitan areas where wiretaps are most common, there's been a changeover in switches since 1994, and so all of them have been enabled by CALEA and probably would be extraordinarily difficult, if not impossible, without CALEA. And so any wiretaps we do now are likely driven by CALEA. Actually, what I think you would see at the local level is that a lot of state and local governments have been slowly priced out of the wiretap market.
Not true, Stuart. The numbers are actually higher for state and local.
They are higher, but I don't think they're as high as they were for state and locals back in the early
90s. They used to be close together. They're now higher.
Okay. All right.
Now, you may be right in the sense they might have gone much higher.
I'm certainly seeing governments basically get out of the business.
So. But what I would disagree with you on CALEA compliant, because the point is the switch is CALEA compliant.
Right.
But if the call didn't use any advanced network communication, then the wiretap would have gone through previously, and that's the part we don't know.
Oh, you mean if okay. I'm not sure that's even here correct, because of the widespread use of mobile technology, which was basically unwiretappable.
So, nice thing about empirical questions is that they're answerable. John, the back.
John Piha. I'm kind of curious about the characterization of onion routing, both as something we're afraid of that will be unleashed on the world, was one comment, or something that's caught on like wildfire was another comment. I actually don't think it's either. It's out there. It's in the world. And every day people do illegal things on the Internet and don't use it for a variety of reasons.
It is an
early case of what we're talking about here. I wonder if either of you would want to comment on what are the lessons, what are the costs and the benefits we've already experienced from onion routing as an example of this.
So I think one of the very interesting benefits is that the entire code and the entire motivation and the ideas behind it are public, and there are attacks on onion routing. And then these guys go back and they work with the technology some more. That's the way security technology ought to be. It should be public. It should be out there. Let me give you an example of security technology that isn't. The U.S. government is using Einstein 3 to protect the communications of federal civilian agencies and protect them against malware. And so it's an intrusion detection and intrusion prevention system. And they use what are called signatures, where they know what types of malware they can expect. There's lots of malware they can't expect. They don't know about yet, but they know some malware they can expect, and they just have to look at transactional information about the malware, and then they say, no, you can't come in. Some of the signatures are classified. They come from the NSA. Reasonable that the signature should be classified in the same way that a cryptographic key is not public information. But the architecture of the system should be public, should be open for public scrutiny in the same way that Tor is open for public scrutiny.
So I was using Tor as an example of a technology which is pure capability and has no ability to be shaped or restricted depending on the uses to which it is put. And I think that's dangerous, and I think there's an infatuation with that in places like Silicon Valley and its exurbs that is not going to serve us well. It is like crypto. It's just enough of a pain, so the only people who are likely to use it are people who really think they have to use it. Unfortunately, not all of those are, the budding human rights campaigners in Burma. So that's my worry. I think we should be looking for, and the State Department should be looking for technologies that allow a little more social control than that. I can't resist addressing Einstein 3. We've had 10 years and 3 presidents tell us that federal systems are under attack by sophisticated cyber espionage efforts and worse. And consistently the response of the cyber libertarians is, oh, my goodness, that sounds like a bad thing. There must be something wrong with that. We think you should do something else, whatever it is. And indeed, notwithstanding what Susan said, the government, this administration has, despite declaring a crisis, not implemented Einstein 3 because it is in part deterred by that strain of political and technological thought. And the result of that is that we have massive attacks on our networks in ways that basically allow attackers in all but a few agencies to record officials' thoughts as they are typing them, to turn on their microphones, to turn on their cameras, and watch them in their offices. Now, it happens that that's not the U.S. government that is doing that, but that is, thanks in part to a cyber libertarian campaign of making us afraid of 1984, that has delivered 1984 to practically every agency in the United States.
So I need to answer that, Stu. My understanding from talking to the folks at DHS is that the delay in deployment of Einstein 3 is they ran an Einstein 3 on a mid-level federal agency, and they ran into trouble. And so they couldn't scale. I don't think it was the techno-libertarians. I, by the way, am from Massachusetts rather than Silicon Valley, even though I used to
work. That
would
be the excerpts.
But it was technical problems in implementation.
It's also not clear to me that Einstein 3 intrusion detection style systems would stop a GhostNet style slow
A lot of those GhostNet attacks begin with malware, and you have to identify the malware and repel it. And indeed, Einstein 3 was held up for years over these libertarian privacy objections. Of course, there's always going to be a period in which you're struggling to make these things work. We're having that period now instead of 3 years ago, precisely because of the objections that cyber libertarians raised.
Not my experience.
Mike, can you introduce yourself?
Mike Nelson at Georgetown University and CSC Leading Edge Forum. I met both Susan and Stuart back in my days in the White House in the 90s when we were trying to figure out clipper chip. It was tough enough to deal with the domestic issues, but the international ones were far worse. And you've touched on those, but I'd like to go back to a couple of really important, hard problems. Suppose we've figured out how to collect this data in the U.S. Suppose we know how to track these people. How do we share that, and with what governments do we share that data that we collect? And then the other piece of this that I'd like you to explore is what kind of message are we sending to the rest of the world when we put forward these policies that say, you know, it's okay for us to close down WikiLeaks or to cut off companies that are hosting people who are doing things we don't like. The case of WikiLeaks and Amazon is one, but DHS in the last couple of weeks have closed down dozens of companies because once part of the company was doing something that was deemed illegal. So how do we get this balance right? How do we cooperate with those countries we should cooperate with? How do we move to some kind of global standard of taking action against illegal activities? I mean, to put it bluntly, if the U.S. has the tools, the U.S. government has the tools to listen in on somebody, do we share them with the Nigerian government or the Russian government?
Well, you've managed to stump me, Mike, but let me try anyway. So there are many parts to your question. And I want to start with economic espionage. So in the United States, economic espionage is a crime. Some of you probably know more about this than I, but it is certainly not a crime in more than three or four other countries in the world, if it is a crime anywhere else in the world. I think the UK it may be a crime, but aside from that, it is not a crime elsewhere. It was very interesting.
I don't think I'd try it in China.
I don't think there are lots of things I would try in China. But you can do economic espionage from China on other countries, and that's considered legal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's not legal also, for the U.S. to do.
Also inside China, it's...
It is. That's an interesting question, whether it's legal for the U.S. government. They don't do it, but I'm not sure it's
so,
illegal.
So I think that... So let me back up from a moment ago. A few weeks ago, Renault had a case in which three of its employees were alleged to have leaked information about their new electronic cars, their new electronic engines, to China. And the French were very upset about it. It's very interesting to me because the French have said quite explicitly that as far as the U.S. goes in military and diplomatic affairs, we're allies, but in economic affairs, they consider us a competitor and an enemy, and economic espionage is quite legit. I would really like to see a change in the world on that. That's a very grandiose idea. But perhaps with this quite shocking case to the French, because they really made a very big fuss about it, we could begin to see a movement that way. So that's one answer internationally. On WikiLeaks, I read a wonderful paper by Yochai Benkler of Harvard Law, in which he discussed the sort of extra-legal efforts of the U.S. government. So Senator Lieberman making comments about how Amazon and others should shut down WikiLeaks and couldn't do it by the U.S. government, but by God, it happened, and what it looked like in the rest of the world. And it looked pretty bad. And the stuff was out there. The other point that Benkler made is that the U.S. press appeared to exaggerate how many of the telegrams and so on were actually publicly available. He quoted press and what they said and what appeared to be the case. The answer is it's very complicated, and I'm not going to give you very much of an answer. When I talk about attribution, when I give one of these technical talks and I do slides, I have a picture of China and I have a picture of France. Or I have a picture of China and I have a picture of the U.S. And in one country, free speech is legal and economic espionage is a crime. And in the other country, free speech is not legal and economic espionage is allowed. The Internet has made international communication easy, but not in the way that we expected 15 years ago. You can't get stuff into Burma, and stuff in Singapore is tightly controlled. And China, well, some stuff goes out, but not exactly what you expect, and so on. And so I don't think there is a 5-minute or even 50-minute answer to your question, so I'll stop here.
We're working on it. So sharing information and technology.
So in my experience, especially in law enforcement, but also in intelligence, there are really no more brutally reciprocal relationships in the world. We should share with the people who share with us, and we should do unto others what they do unto us. I have to say, I think that's our only hope, and I don't think we have a lot of hope. Certainly, hoping that economic espionage will become less frequent because the French have discovered they're on the receiving end of it is I think, an illusion. In fact, you get economic espionage by sophisticated governments whenever you have mercantilist states with heavy interconnections between the government and industry. And we've seen the rise of China with just such a system in the last 10 years, and that makes the likelihood of economic espionage far more serious. In a bid for some area of agreement, I'm going to ask Susan when I finish this if she agrees with me that maybe we should not be buying telecommunications equipment from that
No,
country.
Maybe about it.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Well, then we agree on something. Let me
find
just
where you're going to buy them from.
Well, from the Finns probably, or the Swedes, which is, you know, on the whole, better than the alternative. The French are still in there, though. The other question of what should we be doing and how do we look to the rest of the world? I'll seize this opportunity to say that DHS has to have something better to do than seizing websites devoted to, you know, offering people who want to buy fake trademark goods. That's just bizarre, and their effort to do that is, you know, a sign of how our intellectual property rules have sort of gone off the off the rails. I do think it's a little odd that if the WikiLeaks had been posting Rihanna albums, they would have been shut down by everyone. You know, Amazon.com could not have kicked their butt off of their system fast enough. And the idea that Rihanna gets more protection than Hillary Clinton is, I think, a little bizarre. So my modest proposal in this, and maybe we can agree on this, is that surely when Julian Assange writes his book, we should not allow takedown orders to be sent to the websites that make it available for free to the rest of us.
So just have to put a quick note just to show that Stuart has many interesting positions. He's the only person I know who's written a book which is not terribly kind to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, but is published under the Creative Commons license and is thus available for free download on the Internet. So he does put his money where his mouth is. I think we have time for one last question from the audience in the back. Sorry, gentleman with the mustache.
Yes. John Willis, independent privacy and security consultant. Do you see any, or what value do you see in promoting the use of trusted computing environments for consumer PCs, especially when they're entering regulated environments? I think briefly of a scenario where you know, consider them like a person driving a car, needing a driver's license, you know, registering their vehicle, that sort of thing. You know, for example, would requiring registering your PC key with an ISP be an interesting avenue to go? Just forward thinking, do you see any of those technologies being of interest?
So
right.
I was
2 minutes each on trusted computing.
So coming clean, while I was at Sun, I did some work for Trusted Computing Group, and in particular, I was responsible for the best practices. Now, how they're being implemented is different from writing the best practices, but it took enough time to get them through that at least at the time we did, it was understood that they had real teeth in them. And they talked about usability, they talked about data portability, they talked about privacy. And I would urge you to go to the TCG, the Trusted Computing Group website, and find those best practices, the 1.1 or 1.2, whatever version it was. That said, one never knows how the implementations happen. And in particular, TCG never set up a process by which the standards had to go through a measurement against the best practices. So the best practices were official and officially part of the standards, and they were privacy protective and protective of users' rights. So in particular, it said the TPM and the TCG technologies should not change the ownership model of data. And usability was in there because, of course, if you make it sufficiently difficult to use it, then things get changed on ownership without the user intending. So strong set of best practices, but whether they are actually being implemented in the standards being promulgated by the group is not clear.
So very quickly, I think in the end, if you want to hook up to a network, you're going to have to live by the network's rules, and that means surrendering a lot of autonomy over your machine. The good news is that CPUs are cheap. I think I brought two with me, and I didn't bring a laptop. You just carry them around everywhere. There's no reason why you can't have one CPU that you use to traverse Tor and another that you use to hook up to the network that is trusted and abide by its rules. And that's perfectly legitimate, and of course they should require you to turn on your TPM, and they basically can tell you what you can and cannot install on your machine, as they should if they want to be able to control and secure their network. That's how we're going to end up building whatever islands of security we find ourselves living on, because gradually we'll build networks, we'll tell people if you want to be part of this secure network, you have to give up a whole bunch of anonymity and autonomy over your machine. But the good news is you won't be ripped off every 20 minutes. And I think most of us will take that solution most of the time.
And in fact, the evolution of security in a complex environment is one of the main focuses of the Center for Technology Innovation here at Brookings. And I would like to thank you for all joining me this afternoon and ask you to join me in thanking Susan and Stuart for their presentation. Thank you.